All right, we're ready to look at Matthew 23, the rejection of the nation by the king. This is where the king officially rejects nation Israel. He starts out, though, with an admonition to the multitudes and to the disciples in 23, 1 through 12. Let's read those. 23, 1 through 12. In chapter 23, verse 1, then Jesus spoke to the crowds and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds. For they say things and do not do them. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move with so much as a finger, but they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments. They love the place of honor at banquets and the chief seats in the synagogues, the respectful greetings in the marketplaces, and being called rabbi by men. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. Just a little background. Keep in mind, remember that we're still under the law at this point of time in Matthew. We're still under the law. That's why Jesus will talk about the law and he tells them to observe it. The law was still authoritative. A second factor to remember in these verses is the sin which is gripped by the scribes and Pharisees, hypocrisy. And we'll see that later in 23. We'll see it here in 23, 3 through 7. Look at verse 3, for example. Therefore, all they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds. For they say things and do not do them. That's the perfect description of a hypocrite, somebody who says things and doesn't do them. So their sin is hypocrisy. This is going to be enlarged in Christ's indictment of them in verses 13 through 33, the woes. And we'll get to those in just a moment. The error of their doctrine is that they drove men under the law and failed to lead them by the law to faith in God. And that's the purpose of the law, is to bring men to faith in God. Galatians makes that very clear. By keeping the minutiae of the law, they did not realize that they were missing its moral principles. The big moral principles of the law were getting set aside for the minutiae, the phylacteries, the hems on the garments. There were three groups present now at this point in the temple courtyard. First, the disciples of Jesus. Second, his critics. And third, the crowds of ordinary Israelites. So those three groups are who he's addressing. And Jesus now turns from addressing the Pharisees to speak to the multitudes and his disciples. When Jesus said the scribes and Pharisees had seated themselves on Moses' seat, remember he said that, what he meant by that was that they viewed themselves as Moses' legal successors, possessing his authority. They claimed to possess the authority of Moses. The replacement in verse 8 through 12, here let's read 8 through 12. But do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. Do not be called leaders, for one is your leader, that is Christ. But the greatest among you shall be your servant. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, and whoever humbles himself shall be exalted. Jesus is not saying here that there is no recognition of authority. between leaders and followers. Since the religious leaders of Israel were rejected by the Messiah, the disciples of Jesus were taking their place in the program of God. So there were still leaders. They just changed. They changed from the scribes and Pharisees to the disciples in God's program, not in the Pharisees and scribes program, but in God's program. They changed. Even now in the church today, we have elders, and elders exist to exercise divine authority in the church. He concludes by telling them not to make a leadership position a goal, but rather make it an opportunity to serve others. Now that brings us to 13 through 26, the seven woes. And the woes can be compared, if you want to compare them, they can be compared to the blessed in the Beatitudes, because they do not state a wish, they state a fact. It's a fact he's talking about. It's not a curse that calls down a calamity, but a calm, true judgment and verdict rendered by the supreme judge himself. Six of these woes are attached by means of a hoti clause in Greek. Hoti means because. Because. These furnish the full reason for the verdict. And we'll see the verdicts as we go through this section. The first three announcements of woe are given because of the doctrine of the scribes and Pharisees. The last three is given because of their character. And the middle one is transitional, and it deals with both. Their main problem was they failed to understand Scripture, and that affected their doctrine and their conduct. The religious leaders are found to be guilty of the sin of hypocrisy. Christ emphasizes their guilt in 32 and 33. Verse 33 says, "You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell?" Plummer writes in his commentary, "The quotation has no answer. It is implied they cannot escape this judgment." It's important to note that the perversity of the religious leaders of Israel does not excuse the people. You might say, well, it was their leaders that were wrong, and that means the people weren't. In verse 35, the Lord is not blaming the scribes and Pharisees of his day for the murder of God's representatives. Look at verse 35. "So that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar." So he's blaming all Israel, not just the leaders. They were guilty of willfully following blind guides. They willfully followed the blind guides, the scribes and Pharisees. It's kind of like in the church today. You have people who willfully follow false teachers, and they're going to have to pay account for that. If they don't hear the gospel in their church, they're going to have to pay account for that. And there's plenty of false teachers today, too. So it's clear that the nation, as well as the leaders, were held guilty in God's sight. The most outstanding feature of this section is the severity of the words and the emphasis on judgment. The words Jesus uses are, well, he uses hypocrite seven times, son of hell, blind guides, fools, whitewashed tombs, brood of vipers, in connection with the scribes and Pharisees. He uses all those words. So you can see the judgment that he's giving out to them. Now we have the first woe in 23, 13, and 14. "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut off the kingdom of heaven from the people. For you do not enter in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you devour widows' houses for a pretense. You make long prayers, therefore you will receive greater condemnation. The leaders were hypocrites because they professed to teach God's will, but kept people from entering the kingdom that was God's will for his people to enter. God wanted his people to enter the kingdom, and the scribes and Pharisees kept them from it. They kept the people from entering it by not preparing to enter it themselves, and by discouraging others from doing so. Look back at chapter 18. We'll see what happens to guys like this. 18, 6 and 7. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come. But woe to that man through whom the stumbling block comes. So a very similar passage back in chapter 18. The second woe is in verse 15, 23:15. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel around on sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. The scribes and Pharisees were very zealous to get Jews to subscribe to their doctrinal convictions. It was almost like a contest between the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians. They all had these factions, and they all wanted the Jews to follow their particular faction. And their theology was all corrupt. Since their theology was corrupt, they were doing more harm than good by making a proselyte. The third woe in 16 through 22, verse 16, woe to you, blind guides, who say whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated. You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering on it, he is obligated. You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, whoever swears by the altar swears both by the altar and everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And whoever swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. This is kind of an example of what Jesus said in the second woe. By differentiating between what was binding in their oaths and what was not, the Pharisees and teachers of the law were encouraging evasive oaths that amounted to lying. Well, I swear by the temple. Well, doesn't count. Have to swear by the gold in the temple. Not only that, they had it backwards, because they were saying you have to swear by the gold in the temple, and Jesus said it's the temple that sanctifies the gold. So not only were they making an out, they were swearing by the wrong things. And basically what this is it's like if you were to come up to somebody and make a promise to them and have your fingers crossed behind your back. They're making it easy to lie when you tell an oath. So Jesus' main point is that people should tell the truth, and you don't need an oath on the temple or the gold in the temple. Just speak the truth. The fourth woe, 23 through 24. 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. But these are things you should have done without neglecting the others. So he's saying you should have done. The Mosaic Law required the Israelites to tithe grain, wine, and oil. And if you want to look up a verse for that, it's Deuteronomy 14, 22 to 29. It was a law. And Jesus says, do the law, but don't miss out on the greater laws. They were all concerned with these piddly little laws while they were neglecting the laws like justice, mercy. This judgment, when he directed his condemnation to the leaders' failure to observe the more important commands, this judgment constitutes the most important failure of the scribes and Pharisees. They were distorting the will of God as he had revealed it in Scripture. Look back at chapter 9. And in chapter 9:9, as Jesus went on from there, and this is calling Matthew, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said to him, follow me. And he got up and followed him. Then it happened that as Jesus was reclining at table in the house, behold, as many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and sinners? But when Jesus heard this, he said, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire compassion, not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but the sinners. So he's telling them to go look at their Bibles and look at the important commands, not the piddly little commands. They're out there wondering why Jesus would let the sinners and tax collectors eat without washing their ceremonial washing that Jews do. Never mind the justice. Never mind the mercy. They were all concerned with the little minutiae of the law. The fifth woe in 25 and 26. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of robbery and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and of the dish, so the outside of it may become clean also. So Jesus is condemning the characteristic superficiality with this metaphor. The Pharisees taught the necessity of being ritually clean by observing dietary ritual cleansing routines of the law. But inside they were rotten. He's saying, get your inside act together, and then worry about cleaning the outside. The Jews were to be clean vessels God could use to bring spiritual nourishment to others. And that was the job of the Jews. They were to bring spiritual nourishment and God to the others, but they failed to do that. Clear back in Exodus, God tells them to spread the word, and yet they didn't. They became a separate nation and avoided others. The sixth woe, 27 and 28. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which on the outside appear beautiful, but inside they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. So you too outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Now, a little background on this. The Jerusalem Jews whitewashed grave markers just before Passover to alert the pilgrims of their presence. You know, we looked at it last time, that the population of Jerusalem swelled from 30,000 to 180,000 during the Passover. And a lot of these were strangers that had never been to Jerusalem before. So the people of Jerusalem painted the gravestones and the grave markers, the tombs, with whitewash so that the strangers would know it was there, because if they touched it, they would be ceremonially unclean for a week and they couldn't participate in the Passover. So it was a kindly thing that the Jews in Jerusalem did. But they looked nice, a whitewashed grave marker. Jesus compared these whitewashed monuments to the Pharisees. Both appeared to be attractive. Both also contained people who would contaminate them. Being contaminated by a Pharisee would keep them from the blessing that the Passover anticipated, the kingdom blessings. And being contaminated by the Pharisees, I take it means following the Pharisees' doctrine. Seventh woe, 23:29-36. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build tombs of the prophets and adorn monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had been living in those days, our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So testify against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill, crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. By building monuments to the prophets and other righteous people that their forefathers had murdered, the Pharisees were saying that they would not have killed them if they had been alive then. If it had been me, I wouldn't have done that. I'm too spiritual, too righteous. These construction projects constituted professions of their own spiritual superiority as well as honor for the dead. They not only honored the dead, but they professed their own spiritual superiority. Now, Christians should take a lesson here, because we see some of the things that the disciples did, and we say, how could they do that? I would never do that if I was there. Talk's cheap, and it's easy to look back and say that. So think twice before you say that you wouldn't have done that if it had been you. I would never have eaten the forbidden fruit. I know I would have. I know myself. Now Jesus pronounces the judgment on that generation. In the case of the Jews, the limit of misbehavior has almost been reached. The fact that the judgment for all this violence should come upon this generation indicates its imminence. All hope for turning of Israel to God to repentance is gone. The king has no choice but to reject the nation for the time being with regard to its kingdom program. And that's a clear announcement of this decision in these verses of Matthew. Now in 37 through 39, we have the lamentation over Israel. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her? How often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. For I say to you, from now on, you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So having declared his rejection of Israel, the king sadly laments over her capital city. And in these verses, Jerusalem is looked upon as a representative of the Jewish nation in its attitude and actions towards God. Matthew uses the word thelo twice in this verse. That's verse 37. Who kills the prophets, stones, those who are sent to her. How often have I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you are unwilling. The word means to want or will. Israel was a rebellious nation, pitting its will against the will of the Lord. Even in this expression of sorrow, there are indications of a certain judgment. For I say to you, from now on, you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And you notice I say blessed there and not blessed. There's a different word. Remember when we had the Beatitudes, we went over this. There's two words, two Greek words that are translated blessed or blessed in the English Bible. And I differentiate them by their pronunciation. Blessed in the Beatitudes is the word makarios. Makarios. And what it means is to be happy, basically, to be in a good position. The word used here is a different word when he says, you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And I say blessed in the Beatitudes. Here I say blessed because the word is eulogeo. And eulogeo means to speak well of, basically. To speak well of. By his departure, he was leaving their house to them. Now that brings us to 24 and 25, which go together. And I don't think I'll start 24, but I'll do some background work. John, will you pass these out, please? And I'm going to give you a homework assignment today that I want you to finish by next week. Thank you. Anybody else need one? This is a little overview of prophecy. What we'll be dealing with in Matthew 24 and 25 is this tribulation period. You see a tribulation, 70th week, 7 years. That little section of history is what we'll be dealing with in these two chapters. In the middle of it comes the abomination of desolation. That's in 24:15. Jesus says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place. So we'll be looking at the abomination of desolation. I might as well go over this chart. It starts in Daniel 9, 24 and following. And in Daniel 9, 24 and following, this is one of the key passages in prophecy in the Bible, where it says 70 weeks have been declared for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Now this is this chart in visual form, I guess you'd call it. If you look at verse 25, it says, so you are to know and discern that from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. First, I ought to explain the word seven. It's a heptad. Have you heard of a heptad? It's a seven. It doesn't mean 7 days. It doesn't mean 7 years. Exactly, it does here, but it can mean seven of anything. Now, in time, it's either days or years, and it couldn't be 7 days because they wouldn't have time to rebuild the temple, and the temple was to be rebuilt. It says it will be built again with plaza and moat even in times of distress, so it can't be days. It has to be years. So if you take this, 7 weeks and 62 weeks. That's weeks of years, 7 years. 7 and 62 come to 483 years, a few times it times 7. interesting note. He says, from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. That's the decree of Artaxerxes. And it took place in BC 445. And you can look that up in your Encyclopedia Britannica. That's ancient history. A fellow named Sir Robert Anderson, who was head of Scotland Yard for a while, wrote a book about it called The Coming Prince. And he proved that from the decree of Artaxerxes to the day Jesus rode into Jerusalem on the donkey was exactly to the very day 483 prophetic years. Exactly to the day. The Bible doesn't deal in vague generality prophecies. It deals in facts and details. Following that, it says in verse 26, after the 62 weeks, now that's after the 7 weeks, so it's after the 69 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And that's a reference to his crucifixion. And the people of the prince who was to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abomination will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. That's the abomination of desolation that Matthew was talking about. So we got 483 years. So the next year would be the 70th week. That's 69 weeks, right? So the next week would be the 70th week, right? Wrong. It's very carefully worded here. It says after the 69 weeks. It doesn't say in the 70th week. So the 70th week is postponed. And that is what we call the church age. And the reason I put question marks by the church age is because we don't know how long it is. This little chart isn't drawn to scale, by the way. It's just how it came out. So I have the abomination of desolation in 927 is in the middle of the week. And then starts the Great Tribulation. After the tribulation period, the second advent, that's when Jesus will return. Now the rapture over in the other side, Jesus removes the church. He doesn't return to the earth. He meets us in the air. So believers, Christians, will not take part in the tribulation. There will be Christians in the tribulation. There will become Christians in the tribulation. But all those alive now will be gone when the tribulation begins. Only unbelievers enter the tribulation period. There will be believers, but only unbelievers enter. And then you have the abomination of desolation in the middle of the week. That's 3.5 years in the week. And then 3.5 years later, the second advent. After that, the millennial kingdom that we've talked about so much in Matthew will take place. And the millennial kingdom merges with the new heaven and new earth for an eternal kingdom. And that's what we will participate in as believers. That arrow at the bottom is eternity future. The arrow at the bottom is eternity past. You get some idea of what's going on in there? It might be kind of confusing. That's why I brought it out this week, so you could have little time to look it over, read the verses,